Thank you, Mazen.
First, we need to get the bills open to committee.
House Committee on Revenue for April 16, 2009 will come to order. Representative Thatcher, which bill are you here for?
3181.
We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3181. And who's on that? Paul? Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3181 is directs Department of Revenue to modify the personal income tax form so that we'd had an earlier bill that discussed the surplus kicker refund donations, the option to do that. What this bill would do is include public safety and services for seniors and persons with disabilities as additional options for taxpayers who wish to donate their kicker refunds.
Very good. Representative Thatcher,
Good morning.
Thank you for being here with us this morning.
Thank you for hearing the bill. I'm Kim Thatcher, State Representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. And it's a real simple bill. I'm actually getting a couple small changes made to make the State Department of Revenue happy. And what it has the potential, I think, of generating some decent-sized dividends for our state budget. The bill expands an already good thing, the checkoff program for people who want to voluntarily donate their kicker, which, you know, this is actually a duplicate of a bill I had introduced last session when we were talking about big kickers. And so I hope we'll be talking about kickers again soon. Under the current program, taxpayers can designate whether they want their kicker money to go to the state school fund. And since yesterday was tax day, and I'm sure most of us are sick of looking at our tax forms, but in your packet, hopefully it's getting, I think it's getting passed out right now, is an actual Form 40, and you'll see the box 7E, where you check off for education and donate your kicker money. House Bill 3181 would add two more categories to that portion of the form, one for the Oregon State Police, other for the Department of Human Services. Like I mentioned earlier, we've worked with the Department of Revenue to make sure the bill works for them, and we have amendments in the works which would actually simplify the forms so that the boxes have abbreviations like SCH, DHS, and OSP. The other changes we're working on say that if a taxpayer checks off more than one box, the kicker would just default go to the general fund so that the agency doesn't have to sit and figure out, you know, how to divide it up. The Department of Revenue would prefer we limit this checkoff program to just Oregonians who file the Form 40, which is the full-year resident filers, because it would be easier to accommodate with the space limitations on the form, and the other forms are more difficult to accommodate. So this would accommodate 88% of all the taxpayers in Oregon because they use that form. One last thing, the amendments will fix a small problem in Section 2, Subsection 2. The Treasurer wanted that changed so that the Department of Administrative Services or Department of Revenue are in charge of transferring the funds, not the Treasurer. Now, because you may want to know, inquiring minds may want to know, the first kicker to use this program was in 2002, and that year nearly $700,000 was donated, and for the most recent kicker issued in 2008, nearly 12,000 Oregonians decided to contribute their kicker to kids and the state school fund in 2008, netted a whopping $6.3 million. Every session there's a debate about whether we should keep the kicker, change the kicker, kick out the kicker, you know that. Now we're just wishing we could even talk about having a kicker. The bill should please everyone because it leaves the choice up to the individual taxpayer. I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you again for giving me a hearing.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick question. I'm not sure if I understood you correctly or not. If there's a state school fund box and, say, they pick OSP and they mark two boxes. Correct me if I'm wrong. Did you say if they mark two boxes, the kicker just goes back to the general fund? And would that be the whole kicker?
Mr. Chair, Representative Springer, that would be, yes. It would go to the general fund so they don't have to. It would be written that way. It says if you're going to check more than one box, it will default to the general fund.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
Sure.
Yes, Representative Reed.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Maybe this has already been cleared up. I'm thinking about the abbreviations. Would that be indicated somewhere on the form so that it would be clear to the taxpayer what SCH, OSP, and DHS stand for?
Chair Barnhart and Representative Reed, actually, there are a lot of confusing things on the forms, and that's why there are instructions, and that would be included there.
Yes, Representative Call.
Mr. Chair, and this might be a question for the Department of Revenue. It seems that we'd had some confusion earlier in our session around this checkoff box in general, and that consensus was made, I think, that through the rulemaking process we were going to have a yes or no box to try to have more of an affirmative intent of the taxpayer so that there would be less confusion about whether or not they donated their kicker or not. I'm wondering if this box gets us back into the same situation we were in before, where people could be more confused regardless of the level of specificity in the instruction booklet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, maybe you're referring to the TurboTax issue that occurred. Yeah, I don't know how to answer that one.
I think it's probably
the department. Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Anything else for Representative Thatcher? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3181 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3214. Day. And then we'll hear from Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sal Esquivel.
Excuse me for a moment. I'm going to ask Day to introduce the bill, and then it will be your turn.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. House Bill 3214 authorizes counties to recover costs of property assessment and tax collection from taxing districts by withholding from the property tax collection distribution. Costs to be apportioned among taxing districts are net of funding from CAFA, County Assessment Function Funding Assistance Account. Apportionment is directly proportional to each district's share of total county property tax collections. The cost apportioned among taxing districts may not exceed 2% of each taxing district's distribution that is not bonded indebtedness or interest thereon. So that's the essence of
the bill. Thank you. Now, Representative, your turn.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, colleagues, for the record, Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. I bring to you House Bill 3214, and as been outlined by our revenue staff, this particular bill allows our tax collecting counties, which all of us know that is the tax collector for all special districts, municipalities, etc., throughout your county, the ability to charge up to 2% maximum for that collection process. We're going to have a revenue shortfall here in the future, especially for ONC counties. So therefore, this will give them an opportunity to get back up to a 2% cap, although right now I believe it's about a 1.88% for the collection process, which our county assessor from Jackson County, Dan Ross, will explain a little more detail. This is, if you see, you look at the bill, it is incremental in the collection part. It's not 2% right off the bat or 1.88%. It's over a gradual 25, 50, 75, and 100% over a period of time. So, therefore, it's nothing right up front. The pros and the cons. You're going to probably hear from some people who will say, well, we can't afford that. But on the other side of that coin, you have some people that may look at things very short-sightedly. And what I mean by that is if you can hire assessors and appraisers, not assessors, but appraisers, you're going to increase your revenue stream. because we have the ability to go out and assess the property the way it's supposed to. Right now, most of your counties are way behind on that process. It will raise the revenues in some municipalities as much as 10-11% per year. This is a good thing for them, and they need to get off the short-sightedness of the upfront cost. Now, having said that, your special districts will come in and support this. AFSCME will come in and support this, I believe. So, therefore, there's a lot of support for this. You're going to have some people that will be against it, but for reasons, I think, that need to be looked at very and scrutinized very close by this committee. So, without further ado, I have another committee to go to. I will pass this off to a fellow that I actually grew up with, this guy. We've known each other since we were kids. So, anyway, this is Commissioner Smith from Jackson County, and thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any questions for me?
Thank you. Are there any questions for Representative Esquivel? I think we're going to hear a lot of testimony, and we appreciate your introduction of the bill, Representative. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Barnhart and members of the committee. I'm Dennis C.W. Smith, the Jackson County Commissioner, and I'm here today with our county assessor, Dan Ross, and our county administrator, who basically drafted the bill and can speak to the intent of different aspects of the bill for you if those questions are necessary. This bill is hopefully a part of a resolution to some long-standing funding issues that counties face in this rise and fall of various revenue streams. And we've felt that as badly as anybody can when you go from, I was the elected sheriff in 1973, and I went from 43 road deputies, 1984, newly elected in 1984, and we went from 43 road deputies down to 7. And Jackson County had a drastic fall in revenue, and this constant roller coaster ride on revenue over the course of time has been truly sad and dramatic, and it's been devastating for local governments over the course of time. And what we're trying to do is sort of level that flow of revenue. We have since retrenched. We've done some things that most people would think were counterintuitive, and that's what people may think about this particular bill. We know it's not without pain, and we know that we have some degree of opposition to this bill, but this is precisely the time, not later, precisely the time to implement a retrenchment and a financial approach to resolving a long-standing problem. We look at assessment and taxation as the mechanism. Think of government as a three-legged stool. Assessment and taxation is the mechanism to assure that people are appropriately being assessed and taxed, and those revenue streams are provided to all the districts that receive those funds. Counties have traditionally done it for 150 years free of charge to all the agencies they collect taxes for. The business rule and the rules and the dichotomy has changed substantially. I was on the governor's task force on Forest County payments, and that was before the major information about the shortfall. We worked a year on trying to solve answers and questions about where the state may help the counties. And I have to say that Tim Nesbitt did an absolute yeoman's job on helping counties and also allowing the state agencies to become far more familiar with the complexities of county government. But this creates a stability in that three-legged stool. One is making sure that the revenue streams are steady, adequate, and appropriate, not overdone, but appropriately staffed. The second revenue issue, or the second government issue, is making sure that your governments are running at the peak efficiencies and allowing for that to happen. And the third leg of the stool in relationship is making sure the citizens have the opportunity to have all the economic opportunities that they have. And of course, we're all of us are working on those three legs of that stool. But this is a key component. Revenue is a key component to keep government stable so those services can be provided. I said that this is counterintuitive. It is counterintuitive, and a lot of people are not going to like it. We know that. We've already been told that the League of Oregon Cities is very unhappy with this particular bill. But we know and we can prove from our own statistical information that we increased revenue to all of those districts, including the cities, by adding staff and keeping staff adequately staffed in assessment and taxation. And this does that. You're going to hear from assessors saying this is the first consistent relief. There's a number of bills before you. One is the interest from, I don't remember the bill number. It's a good bill, but the problem with that interest rate, it just rises and falls. It's not consistent. This provides a consistency for everyone. It provides for everybody being a stakeholder in the process. We do have some support among a lot of people, and you'll hear from other commissioners as well. We've pulled a lot of independent commissions, the commissioners, and they are supportive, and we'll be able to provide those numbers for you at a later date. But what this does, just in a nutshell, is it basically it eliminates all those shortfalls. It now demands that everybody that's receiving the benefit of these services pay an administrative upfront cost for doing that over the course of time. And it then offsets and creates a smooth-running mechanism. It's not a windfall by any stretch of the imagination. It doesn't eliminate CAFA altogether. But what it does is it creates that mechanism to be steady over the course of time, and you don't have that part of county government that's constantly rising and falling with various revenue streams that are impacted by, in our case, timber receipts or federal allocations for replacement of timber receipts. So it sets that component, and it sets all of those public agencies, special districts, schools, the cities, with a consistent and a process for them to participate as real stakeholders. We don't hear from them very often unless there's a real shortfall or even when we have reductions in assessment and taxation, which we've all had. And it eliminates that process and creates a more long-term consistent issue. This is, in my estimation, a good way to approach a business and a good way to approach this issue for the long term. And I know it's not without consternation. I understand that, the angst that's going on. But we don't have much time now. This is the window of time for all of us to buckle down, figure out how we can retrench, and figure out how we can do a better job of creating revenue streams for the mechanism, which is assessment taxation, for the flow of services and funding to all these taxing entities. And Assessor Dan Ross is here, and he's available for any other comments. I have our county administrator, Danny Jordan, who helped draft the bill with legislative counsel. So he's here as well. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ross, did you want to be heard?
Yes, I do.
Please, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dan Ross. I'm the Jackson County Assessor. I've been Jackson County Assessor since 1989. I've been with the assessor's office off and on since 1978. I've seen incredible changes in my time at the assessor's office. In 1983, half the county went away due to the timber revenue issues. At that time, the Department of Revenue came in, spoke with the Budget Committee, convinced the Budget Committee that the assessment and taxation was a state-mandated fund. And so in July of that year, we all were laid off in January. In July of that year, most of the appraisers and staff came back into the assessor's office. At that time, we had 85 employees in the assessor's office and the tax collection office. Currently, we have 45 employees. In 1989, my first year as assessor, House Bill 2338 passed. And what it did was provide some funding to offset assessment and taxation for the counties. There were two streams of generation. One was the recording fees that came through the clerk's office. The other was the interest on delinquent taxes, so a portion of the interest of delinquent taxes. In the first few years, that began, we received about a 30% offset for our budgets. That increased to about 40% when recordings and the legislative appropriation monies were added to the CAFA funds. Currently, we are now at 23%, and that is declining. with budget issues that were looming in the mid-90s, my office was asked to cut half of our staff, again, due to ONC revenue issues. At that time, the county would have been out of compliance had that occurred, and we were able to convince the budget committee at that time that if we kept the appraisers, we eliminated, over a two-year period, we eliminated five appraisers, but if we were able to just do the elimination of the five appraisers, we could stay in compliance and be a part of the CAFA program. And they allowed us to do that. The difference was, in those days, we were in compliance. We were doing our six-year reappraisals. We had all our appraisals were up to date. And we were able to do some things, to efficiency things that could change the way we did our appraisals. And we were able to stay in compliance. We are in a much different situation than that right now. Currently, and I'm speaking for myself, but I know that many other assessors are in the same boat, because of Measure 50 and the elimination of the requirement to do six-year reappraisals, many counties are 12 to 18 years out of compliance. In other words, we have not been on those properties physically for 12 to 18 years. In 2006, I requested an audit from the Department of Revenue and our internal audit staff. Through that audit, it was discovered that we were deficient in our appraisal staff. We were able to add four appraisers that year in 2006. And since 2006, we have been able to appraise about 40% of the backlog. We have brought an additional $2.3 million of omitted property. In other words, property that, because we had not been on the property for the 12 to 18 years, there were houses that were missed, there were barns that were missed, there were the spaces above garages had been converted into living spaces, basements had been converted into living spaces. And so, in addition to the $2.3 million that we brought to each of the all of the taxing districts involved, we also brought current money, which grows by the constitutional 3% each year. These positions are now in jeopardy because of cutbacks. The special appropriation from the legislature has been reduced this current year, and it is threatened to be reduced in the upcoming biennium. That represents about $126,000 for Jackson County, which is equivalent of two appraisers' positions. But even while the state grants are reduced, the Department of Revenue requires counties to provide adequate staffing to participate in the CAFA grant process. Assessor's office provide important function to the constituents of the counties, as well as taxing districts that utilize the revenue from local property taxes to provide vital services to county residents. At an individual property level, when assessments are not up to date, uniformity is compromised. One taxpayer may pay more than they should and another less. This can also cause broad funding inequity, and often that what is not collected by property tax must be offset by state revenue. We cannot afford to allow the system to erode beyond where it is already. With the current decline in property values under the Oregon property tax law, when market value dips below the Measure 50 value, it becomes taxable value. If the market value assigned to by the assessor is not accurate, it could very well affect the amount of tax and corresponding distribution to all the taxing districts. I would encourage you to look at House Bill 3214, Senate Bill 563, I believe it is, the one with the delinquent tax, and there's another one out on the recording fees. It seems that especially in difficult times that we are experiencing, we would not want to reduce the vital means of revenue generation that assessment taxation provides. I thank you for your time, and I will entertain any questions that you may have.
Questions? Representative Vail?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at this for, I'm haven't spent a lot of time looking through it, so I apologize if these questions have been addressed already.
Sure.
So is it correct to say that this would allow the county to recover the costs up to that 2% of the distribution? Is that correct?
That's correct. What the way the formula would work is that our budget, we would have a budget, and our budgets are actually for the CAFA grant include assessment taxation, part of the clerk's office with BOPTA, and some IT things. What would happen is we would subtract the CAFA grant, the parts of the recording fees and the interest on delinquent taxes. If there is a legislative appropriation, that would also be subtracted from our total budget, and then there would be a net budget. That is the budget that would be distributed over the taxing districts, excluding the bonds.
Paul?
Yes, please.
So currently, if you had to ballpark it, are your costs about at that 2% mark? Are they less than that 2% mark, and the 2% gives you headroom in case costs increase? Is it more than 2%, but that's what you've settled on is 2%? Where are your costs in relationship to that 2% mark?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, for Jackson County, we would be looking at 100%, which is in 4 years' time. In other words, it's not going to happen this year. There's nothing that happens this year. But in the next year, it'll be 25% of that budget, 50% of the budget the following year, 75%, and 100% in 4 years. At 100% in Jackson County, we would be looking at about 1.7%. So we would not even hit the 2%. However, on the way up here with the assessor from Douglas County, we were figuring his, and the 2% would not cover his costs. The county would still have to come up with about $400,000, give or take a few dollars, in that formula.
A lot of that, we have 49 taxing entities that we collect taxes for in Jackson County, and it would vary from county to county based on the number of entities they're collecting for, and, of course, by population and the whole variables that go into that.
Yes, please, go ahead. Yeah.
And would you say, you gave a couple of examples there, would you say that there are more cases in which the costs are lower than that 2% than there are cases in which those costs are above 2%?
Chairman, Representative Bailey, my guess is that the 2% would not cover most of the counties because there are not enough. We have a lot of taxing districts. I mean, we collect $227 million in taxes, where in Douglas County they're only collecting 82. And their tax rate is so low in Douglas County.
I think Danny's got some.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Danny Jordan, Jackson County Administrator. This is based on information from the Department of Revenue website. The cost to counties for assessment and taxation statewide is about $91,500,000. CAFA grants and special payments cover about $21,570,000, so that leaves a net cost of almost $70 million to the counties. At 2% for all of the counties statewide, it would cover about $56 million, and that would leave about $14 million statewide for the county's costs. And I don't have that broken out by county. I have it broken out by the state.
So would it be correct then, sorry, Mr. Chair?
Please, go ahead, yes.
So it would be correct to assume then that 2% is probably what the taxing districts are going to see in terms of the distribution of these funds. Is that correct?
It would be my guess that most counties would see that, yes.
Okay.
And the more successful you are, the larger that 2% gets and the less the counties have to pay.
Chairman Barnhart,
assuming there's headroom in the
right.
In the assessment process,
I would hope that the more successful we are, we're going to bring in more revenue for the taxing district.
Yeah,
to help offset that.
Thank
exactly.
you. That's what I was trying to say.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Other questions for this panel? Let me ask. I'm sorry, Representative Benz, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The term taxing districts, does that include the county? Because the county collects its own revenue. So are you allocating then it sounds like you're, if the county itself is mm-hmm. included in those 49 taxing districts, then that's not really additional revenue, is it? We could receive that anyway.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, it's not additional revenue. Oh. There is a portion to the county, so the counties will always share in a portion of the cost as a participant in that 2%. I think in our county it's roughly $600,000, if I remember correctly, up to the 1.78% that Dan talked about for the, all of the taxing districts combined.
I would just be interested in the percentage. Of the 49 taxing districts, how much of that is already county? And basically, you're going to be receiving that in any event. It's like 10%, 5%. I'm just curious how much the county how much you're currently receiving for the work that you're doing that will be included in the same device you put together here.
We don't receive anything right now from the taxing districts from what we're currently doing. We receive our portion of tax collections for the county's roughly $30 million in property tax that we receive. That isn't specifically for the cost of assessment. That's for all of the functions of services that the county delivers. However, it does go to cover a cost of assessment and taxation. In our county, we're paying about $2.6 million in general fund at this point to operate on top of the CAFA funds and the special payments. Assessment and taxation. So we would not pay $2.6 million. We would be paying about $600,000. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And that's about what I figured, too.
Thank you. I have a couple. This bill doesn't relieve the county, or does it, relieve the county of its primary responsibility to make certain that assessment and tax collection are paid for. It simply gives it another source of funds.
That is correct.
So if this 2% doesn't cover the cost and the CAFA addition doesn't cover the cost, the county still is required to pony up the balance just as it is responsible for that now.
That is correct. In Douglas County, it would be about $400,000 in addition to what they would pay with the 2%.
Okay. Now, the vast majority of counties, probably maybe all of them, would spend less on assessment and taxation than they do now. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. One other subject. You indicated the things that would come off of the top. You indicated CAFA was one, expenditures from the legislature. The exception that I note in here is for the CAFA fund, and that you won't assess on levies to pay bonded indebtedness or the interest. I assume that's partly because you want to make sure that a school district going out for a bond can say all the money is going to go to the new school.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I might interrupt,
please.
I worked with legislative counsel on drafting the bill.
Yes.
The issue there is actually a legal issue with bonds.
Constitutional issue.
Yes. It's not just and there was a question about urban renewal districts because the way that counties collect, they collect the tax and then convert it via de jure bonds to fund urban renewal projects. We left urban renewal out as well just because it there was not the legal research available on it and it made the bill controversial.
Okay, so this sub B, line 17 and 18 of the bill, cover urban renewal situations as well as the things that are more common?
It covers any bond indebtedness.
Any bond indebtedness. Okay. Then the last question I have in this topic, at least, is when the legislature adds funds, does it do it through the CAFA account or in some other way?
Mr. Chair, my understanding is it goes to the CAFA as an appropriation from the legislature.
All right. So accepting the CAFA account covers everything else.
Correct. And it's very odd timing. The way, in essence, the bill that created the CAFA changed budget law in Oregon.
Yes,
and it did that for counties because we have to certify our CAFA prior to when we would adopt our budget. And so when we certify CAFA, we certify our staffing levels, and that is the thing that equates this across all of the counties. Because you might ask, well, what if one county is overstaffed and one county is understaffed? And you probably have your Department of Revenue representatives explain this better than I. However, they have a standard that they qualify counties for in terms of what your staffing levels need to be. And there's a range because they can't be exact, and there's differences in every county. However, that's what they base how they award the CAFA amounts on, and it's a standard for all 36 counties. And so that's why we felt that the 2% applied at the current staffing levels based on everyone currently receiving the CAFA was appropriate in terms of picking, you know, where, what is the appropriate level of staffing, and so that counties weren't overcharging up to that 2%, or if you understand what I'm saying, so that they weren't building up their staff just because they had access to the 2%.
I see. All right, thank you. That was a question I hadn't gotten to yet, but I appreciate that answer. How much did it cost you to raise the $2.3 million that you believe you brought in after you staffed up after 2006? How much did that cost?
It was approximately $250,000.
Okay, so you're raising $9 for every dollar you spend in the incremental staff.
Yes.
Are you?
It doesn't quite pay. It didn't pay the county's portion of that. In other words,
no, I understand that because of the way the because of the way the distribution system works.
Exactly.
The county had to put money, more money into it than it received back.
Exactly.
But in terms of the total amount received, it was a 9-to-1 thereabouts.
Yes, it was.
All right. That fits very much with what we understand happens when we adequately staff the Department of Revenue for income taxes, for example.
And this may or may not be across the board with all counties, because you have a lot of counties that are...
You were quite a bit behind, weren't you?
Well, most counties are behind, but you know, you have a lot of eastern Oregon counties where there just isn't anything going on, and there probably hasn't been anything going on, so there may not be that extra revenue put in to offset the budgets of the taxing districts. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, it does. Thank you. Does that generate any other questions from the committee? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This would, I guess, take into its ultimate carryout in 4 years, reduce possibly these other districts' budgets by 2%. So I assume that's who we're going to hear from. Am I incorrect there? Please tell me what it reduces it by. Tell me what it reduces the other budgets by.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz. The issue is, assuming that there was no new additional tax created, it would reduce it by 2%. But in our county, we've proven that doing the reappraisals enhances the tax base. So although it may be a charge of up to 2% to those districts, the offset in those districts will be the additional revenue that we generate, and that will vary by county, as our assessor just explained. We don't know exactly. It could, the worst case scenario is it could be up to 2%. However, it could, the new taxes could cover the whole cost.
And in your county,
well, it was,
if you were on this system in 2006 when you started the ramp up, would this have covered the districts? Would this have covered the district's 2%, the $2.3 million that you raised?
No. As an example, the city of Medford, I figured by the time that's at 100%, would be somewhere around $500,000 to offset assessment taxation. Over the 3 years, we have brought in about $342,000, or million, or $1,000, excuse me.
For the city.
For the city in back taxes. That's not to include the new monies that are growing by 3% each year. That's just back taxes, one-time thing.
Great.
Mark? It was interesting to note when the assessor came to the budget committee, of which three commissioners and three lay members are on there, we knew that there was a margin of window of decision-making that we had between what the state Department of Revenue expected from us to have at staff. But we went beyond that and added enough bodies that we felt would provide enough revenue. And we were hoping, naturally, that we would have enough revenue to cover our own costs, but we didn't. But we had sufficient enough revenue to increase revenue to all of the taxing entities and increase that. And that's where this margin, and it's my belief that most of the districts will have a return greater than the amount taken. Most of the districts. So.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate your coming all this way to describe this bill for us.
Thank you.
I'm going to call the others who've marked the 100-mile box. Bob Main, Connie Roach, Robert Thomas.
Right.
Please, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the Revenue Committee. I'm Bob Main. I'm Coos County Commissioner, former county assessor, was in the assessment and taxation system since 1974. I'm here to talk about why the cities should support this bill. And let me give a little example here. In my county, by having all the districts, and I have 78 districts, taxing districts in Coos County, of which Coos is one of them, they would free up over $1 million in revenue just to Coos County General Fund monies. Now, what does that mean? It means that when we cut 249 jail beds to 97 jail beds last year, and we cut 28 deputies to 8 deputies, that meant that currently if someone burglarizes a home in Coos County and they just happen to get caught, they are brought into the county jail, processed, and released the same day most times, unless they come in at night. Investigations are not being performed in the county for burglaries. The citizens are asked to write down what they think they lost, send it in on a report form to the sheriff's office. If the sheriff's office or the city police departments happen to find that those items, they can be returned to their owners. Most drug offenses are not being prosecuted by the DA's office. Most people are being cited and released. They come to the court, but they receive a citation and a fine, and that is it. Why this would benefit the cities and why it would affect the cities, as you know, OEC revenues are going to be at 40% in a couple years. We are at status quo right now with our reauthorization, and we received in my county about $5.2 million. We're going to receive 40% of that. So that $1 million extra by this bill would greatly help us in a few years when it fully ramps up. If we have to cut back the number of jail beds from 97 to something else, of which 30 of those are 1145 beds, which are state beds, we're not going to hold prisoners, which means our crime rate is increasing now, but it's going to dramatically increase in the cities. And I have 7 cities, Coos Bay, North Bend, et cetera. That crime rate is going to escalate even more than it already has been. Why they would be on board? If we are allowed to have this bill and we can increase the jail bed space by more jailers, increase the number of deputies, and increase the DA district attorney assistance, we can prosecute those people and hold those people, and it would greatly help the cities, of which most of the prisoners come from our 7 cities in Coos County. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Please, go ahead.
Chair Barnhart, Honorable Committee, my name is Rob Thomas. I'm the current assessor of the Lincoln County. Our county seat is Newport, Oregon. And it's always a pleasure to talk to folks that have a job that's just as tough as mine. I don't get to very often. I just want to give you a few facts about Lincoln County. I'm considered to be a medium-sized county, both geographically and number of property accounts. So I might be representative of quite a few counties, although I only speak for myself. We spend about $2.7 million on assessment and taxation in Lincoln County, and right now the CAFA funds are providing us about 22% of that. The best case scenario over the years has been about 30%. So with my estimation of what this House Bill 3214 would do for Lincoln County, after it was fully implemented and together with the CAFA funds, we would get about 67% of our A&T funding and after having hit the 2% limit. In Lincoln County, right now we're facing some significant budget reductions. My particular county has been closely monitored by the Department of Revenue because we had some significant layoffs on the implementation of Measure 5 back in 1997, or Measure 50. And As a result, there's a staffing study out that the Department of Revenue seems to update about every year. Right now, before I sustain any more cuts, I am down about three FTEs from what I should be for meeting their minimum standards. I'm not sure how I get away with that, but I think I've got a number of overachievers in my office. So right now, with the proposed budget in Lincoln County, I stand to lose a maximum of six people or a minimum of three. And what that obviously is going to do is pit the Department of Revenue yet again against my budget committee. And as you well know, assessment and taxation is not nearly as popular as other programs that also want to be funded. So I guess I'm not here for sympathy. I'm just here for some opportunity for me to make a fair and equitable system, and to do that I'm going to need at least minimal staff, which I may not be able to have this coming year.
Thank you. Please.
Okay. Representative Barnhart and members of the committee, thank you for hearing us today. I'm Connie Roach. I'm Josephine County Assessor. I've been in that position since January. I have worked in the assessor's office since 1997, so I was there just before the implementation of Measure 50. It changed just at that time. When I first went into the assessor's office, we had approximately 28 positions doing assessment, of course, the six-year cycle. Now we are at 18 FTEs. There are properties in our county that we have not seen since 1993 because of not, we really had to focus on new construction where we knew that there was new construction because there were permits. Of course, there's the unpermitted or the missed permit that we miss. And because we're not on the six-year cycle, we don't get to see that. I want to speak to that a little more, but before I do, I will just point out that for Josephine County, what this bill would mean, when we factor out the county's part of the as one of the taxing districts, I would estimate that when fully implemented, the other taxing districts would share about 46% of the cost of assessment and taxation in Josephine County, with approximately 23% from CAFA and approximately 29-30% still coming from the county. So the county would still have quite a bit of a share in that. We're not relinquishing our share, but in our county, the general fund is so low that it really just covers mandated services. There's really nothing left over for public safety or anything of that nature. So if we can free up even a little bit, I'm sure that in our county it would probably go to public safety, where we have a sheriff who has to answer calls because he's so low on deputies, puts himself in danger quite often. An aspect that I would like to touch on is that, for as an example, I'm just going to give you an antidote or an incident that happened this year. Because permits are down, we are taking opportunity to go out and look at some of those properties we haven't seen in many years. And one of those properties that we came to this year, we found a brand new house that we didn't know was on the, should have been on the roll probably the last 10 years. Of course, we can only go back 5 years to collect the tax on that. But what has happened is that that person who we would have caught in the six-year cycle a long time ago is now hit with a $7,000 tax bill in this awful economy. And there's really not anything we can do about that. It has to happen. But it's an example of what happens when we aren't able to go out more timely to these properties. If we had been on a better position to go out and see these properties sooner, it would have been caught sooner. He wouldn't be being hit this hard at this time. And that's just one example. The other thing that I would mention is that we will get people coming into our office asking about their property, and they will mention, oh, my neighbor laughs because he's getting away with it because he did this and you don't know about it. And of course, they're not even going to tell us who this neighbor is. But there's kind of that attitude out there, too, is that, you know, we're not able to go out there, so we're not catching us, ha, ha, ha. And, you know, I think those are things that we want to be able to address, and it's stable funding that would help us to do that.
And thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The argument's been made multiple times, and it's a valid one, that although the taxing districts would see a decrease because of the up to 2% phased in over 4 years, that would be ultimately recovered and surpassed because of the additional staff in the assessor's office. Makes sense. So as I look at the bill and have listened to the testimony, and maybe I'm missing it in here, maybe CAFA plays a role in this, what is the mechanism that assures those additional funds are spent on additional assessor's office staff, and it doesn't go to law enforcement so the sheriff doesn't have to answer calls? See, I'm thinking that's a great, great point, but what assures that occurs and there's not just simply ultimately 4 years down the road a 2% hit and there is no additional assessing?
I would answer that. That decision is up to the county commissioners and their budget committee. It's not up to the assessor, although we closely listen to the assessor and their needs and the Department of Revenue. And Department of Revenue does have minimum staffing requirements. And most counties, being in that business for a long time, I always thought the minimum staffing requirements were not adequate. Far from it. And I think in my county, we're probably at least 20% short for staff to do a adequate job, not a good job, but an adequate job of finding those properties.
Follow up, Mr.
Yes,
Chair?
Yes, please.
Thank you. If I caught this correctly earlier, it is your county, I'll just boil it down to your county, is your county at the minimum staffing requirements now?
I'm sorry, before Representative Barnhart, Representative Springer. We barely met the minimum staffing requirements last year when I was county assessor. I don't, and at this point, we are having budget sessions so far. In our first budget sessions, we are still at status quo. However, we do not know what's going to happen on May 15th when the state comes out with their new budget projections and the cuts to the counties. We are going to have to scramble and re-look at every department's budget. So we may be below those minimum, very minimum, staffing requirements.
I guess probably more of a concern than a question at this point. My concern is you have those minimum staffing levels currently, mm-hmm. which I'm sure are not adequate. I would agree with that. And my main concern is that we have the mechanism in place to assure that 2% is recovered at some point for the local taxing districts, that there's that mechanism to cause that money, at least a significant portion of it, to go into the assessor's office so they can do exactly what it is you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What are your five largest taxing districts?
Representative Barnhart's got Representative Benz. The five largest ones would be the schools, obviously, the cities, as a collective. That would probably be our largest ones, and the community college. And then way down the list is the county. In my county, the total percentage of revenue is about 7%. of the total tax collected to run the entire county? Not just A&T, but the entire county. We're, I think, third from the bottom in tax rate for counties. We were one of the ones that were in dire straits before the additional money came through from the federal government on the O&C funds. We were talking with Curry County about what we were going to do to be stay solvent as a county.
Other questions? Thomas indicated what this program would do for him in terms of a percentage of the cost of the assessment and taxation. What would it do for these other for the other two counties?
Well, like I said, we would be able to maintain the assessor's office and possibly add staff. And right now we're talking about changing the computer system for A&T, and that's...
Right. Let me clarify my question.
Maybe I didn't understand.
He indicated that currently he gets 20-some-odd percent from CAFA, and he says he could get up to 67% of the cost of the assessment and taxation if this program were in effect. Could you give us similar numbers for the, your two counties?
Representative Barnhart, Coos County is almost similar in size and nature in Lincoln. It would be almost the same.
Okay.
Okay. Senator Barnhart, again, for the taxing districts, excluding the county, about 46 to 47% of the cost of assessment and taxation would be covered by this bill.
So it's very similar to Lincoln County.
I'm talking 46 to 47. He's in the 60s, so it would be a lot less to us, but it would still be.
Does that include the CAFA funds?
I'm sorry, CAFA about 23%.
Right. So add those two together, you get numbers that are very similar to the numbers that Mr. Thomas was indicating for Lincoln County. I think that's helpful information. I'm very concerned about the issue raised by Representative Springer. That was an issue that concerned me a lot. And I think that those who are proponents of this bill need to think about how we would address that issue. Because if we were going to, if there was any chance at all of passing a bill like this, it would have to include virtual guarantees that the office would become fully functional and fully staffed, that it simply wouldn't be a way for the county to offload costs without beefing up these offices to make them actually function the way they're supposed to. And I think Representative Springer is on to a very, very important aspect of this bill that I don't think is covered here so far. But rather than saying any more at this point myself, let's go on with the next panel, shall we?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's hear from Annette Spickard, Hasina Squires, and Ralph Groner. And I will note that I have two more witnesses after after this, and I would like to finish in 15 or 20 minutes, so let's keep it brief. Annette, would you like to begin?
Sure. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Annette Spickard, Lane County Assessor and President of the Oregon Assessors Association this year. Thank you so much for hearing my colleagues this morning and also our county commissioners that we work with. I'm not sure there's a whole lot more that I can add to their testimony. I think they covered all of the key points very well. I will tell you that the Assessors Association is interested in any dialogue or additional work with our tax districts that we serve to work towards a fair solution around funding of assessment and taxation services so that we can better support their revenue needs and also the needs of the taxpayers. We all know that the economy and budgets have changed quite a bit since the interim before this session started, and we did have some dialogue prior to the session starting. And so the association is happy that that Jackson County has brought forward an additional concept for you to consider. You've already heard from me previously about issues around CAFA and county budgets, and so this is one more option for you to consider in your deliberations this session on how to provide flexibilities to counties to meet their mandates. And so we look forward to working with whichever group would be interested in pursuing this concept with us. And I will take any questions if you'd like to ask in regards to the overall association interest.
Hasina doesn't seem to be here, so let's have Mr. Chalmers come forward as well. And let's hear from Mr. Chalmers and then from Mr. Groner.
Chairman Barnhart, my name is Paul Chalmers. I'm the Director of Assessment and Taxation for Umatilla County in Eastern Oregon. Just as a point of reference, 19% of every tax dollar goes to the county function. 19 cents on every dollar that comes into the county goes to county function. 51% goes to education, and the balance is cities and special districts as far as our collection. I think it's important, and Mr. Barnhart, Representative Barnhart, and Representative Springer, to provide you with some clarity on the CAFA issue. Where we find the struggle is the Department of Revenue is torn, in my experience, between minimum staffing levels and adequate staffing levels, because it becomes a power struggle between the county board and the assessment taxation function. And with this, where I see the benefit from this bill is to provide some stabilized funding sources so the Department of Revenue would have some latitude in saying, concretely, we need not minimum staffing levels, we need adequate staffing levels. And I think that hopefully would cover some of the concerns that you raised in the transference of dollars that would come through the door and be used for other purposes. In 1997, when we implemented Measure 50, I cut half my appraisal staff. We currently do no maintenance cycle in Umatilla County. There are properties that we have not looked at since 1994, 1993, physically. At this point in time, we do new construction primarily only. And when we lost half our appraisal staff in 1997 with the elimination of the six-year cycle, indeed there are number of instances that take place where properties are improved to the extent that we don't even have the capacity for discovery. We just don't have staffing levels to adequately do that. One prime example that we did stumble on because of the size of that was a hay shed cover that was actually a three-bedroom, two-bath home. Non-permitted. Because farm dwellings aren't required to pull permits. Farm buildings aren't required to pull permits. So it is a concern in Eastern Oregon. There's no doubt in my mind that the discovery process with adequate funding would certainly generate a surge of dollars, and then the attempt there would be to maintain that surge. So I appreciate your time today from Eastern Oregon.
Thank you very much. Mr. Groner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will speak rapidly. I'm Ralph Groner with AskMe. I represent cities in these counties, been all the counties except Jackson, but Medford we represent. I also represent special districts for AskMe, all three, but I very strongly support House Bill 3214, since for 30 years I've proposed the same proposal, primarily starting with Tom McCall as governor, and the reason the McCall tax plan came forward was because we had the problems in assessment and back in that era, and by the way, we're back. And what am I saying? It starts with when I was county commissioner for 8 years in Clackamas County, I can tell you practical politics a little different than you've heard from assessors. The fact is, when you have 100 to 200 people coming in front of your budget in behalf of public safety, I'll be damned if you're going to give the assessor a whole lot of money, because primarily not because of that so much as it is people don't understand the tax system, including, to my dismay, most county commissioners, and by the way, I didn't. So I went off and did a paper on it for my graduate work, so I've been involved with the assessment issue now for years, so I'll bottom line it.
The assessor probably is the least popular politically office in the county, yet similar to the State Department of Revenue with income taxes, you make, and you do, and I did on Revenue Committee, we make sure that the State Department of Revenue has adequate funding so that we bring more revenue into the general fund, and I'd like to comment a little different about schools and general fund. If we were to go with the 2%...
On this bill?
Yes, on this bill. If we were to follow this bill, it will help the general fund, and I haven't heard that yet, of Oregon, because Measure 5, for example, said the responsibility for making up the difference is, in fact, the state income tax. To the extent that we could should require in the bill, by the way, these dollars go to do what you want, and that's a simple amendment. Excuse me, that's a couple sentences. The fact of the matter is that this in my county, Clackamas County, and in Marion County, Multnomah County, Lane County, the fact is we've grown, and the increased growth isn't caught. Two reasons. Personal property, I only know of one county in the state, that's computers, business kinds of property. Only one county, Multnomah, has extra staff to go out and make sure they're updated. The others do not. They bring in hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, in Multnomah County for everyone to use in Multnomah County because they can do that. If we had extra staff and could provide the staffing we need in Oregon just on personal property to go out into the field, it would make a difference. Secondly, Measure 4750 provided probably an opportunity. I despise it. That's why I've supported a task force for some time now of the revenue chair.
Yeah, on this bill, if you would,
on this bill, but it's all related. And the fact is, under 4750, you need new staff in the assessment level to pick up the new construction that will help offset the general fund cost of Oregon because that new construction improves the property taxes that come into K-12 at the local level, as well as community colleges, substantially if done right. So my point is we have been short of assessment and tax to the point we came here in 89. Thank you. We're back because it's inadequate. If we were the Department of Revenue and it was inadequate, you would see quite clearly you needed money to help you raise more money. You get what you pay for. It takes money to make money. Quite frankly, we have to have an up-to-date assessment system in Oregon, not only to help local special districts, cities, and the county, but the general fund of Oregon. Therefore, I support 3214.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Ms. Speckard, are you still active as a leader in the association? For your profession?
Yes.
Can you tell us whether the general gist of what we've been hearing this morning applies to the other counties we've not heard from?
Yes. In fact, there's several people here that I think are still here. If you're an assessor, you can raise your hand. But we did ask folks to... Yes, and so we did ask folks to start looking at this bill and to please provide me with some information around what it would look like for them locally. And I can tell you that the stories are very similar across the state.
And given that we have extremely limited time this morning, I would really appreciate their comments in writing if they could give it to us.
Sure.
Brief, one page would be wonderful, and I'd have it distributed to the committee if it gets to the Legislative Revenue Office or to me.
I'd be happy to do that.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's hear from Michael Novick, David Williams, and Tricia Smith. You next.
Good morning. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Novak with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this morning to speak in opposition to House Bill 3214. Now, the League was disappointed to learn about this bill because in 2007 and 2008, representatives from the state, the cities, the schools, counties, and the assessors group groups met to consider revenue sources that might be utilized to help stabilize property tax administration functions in Oregon. Now, this group agreed to focus only on ideas on which the group could reach consensus. The idea proffered up in House Bill 3214 was put on the table and apparently summarily rejected. Rather, to provide greater funding for county collection of revenues, the group decided to move forward with placing delinquent interest on property taxes into the CAFA fund. As you've heard, this program is funded by a variety of sources, provide extra financial resources to counties for assessments and collections. This particular idea has come forward this session in Senate Bill 536, and the bill was requested by the Association of Oregon Counties and is supported on the record by the League of Oregon Cities. It's already had a hearing on the Senate side in Senate Finance and Revenue. We feel that Senate Bill 563 is a better mechanism to assist counties with property tax administration functions, and House Bill 3214 is the wrong idea and certainly the wrong time. It was said earlier it's only fair for cities to pay their share. Now, what this ignores is what cities provide to everyone. Cities contribute greatly to the economic well-being of the state. 80% of the income tax is generated within cities. City infrastructure provides framework for the function of the economy. City services provide the benefits of strong communities that attract people and businesses. That's police, that's firefighters, that's water, sewer, parks, libraries. Now, the economic crunch has hit everyone hard, and in the best of times, most cities don't have the reserves to absorb the impacts of this bill. A recent survey of Oregon cities showed that they're hurting in dramatic fashion. One-third have seen dropping property taxes, and unfortunately, these budgetary shortfalls are already impacting services, forcing cities to consider decreasing their workforce, which is almost the only thing they have left to cut. House Bill 3214 would only compound this burden, and I urge the committee to oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association, also here in opposition to House Bill 3214. I'll spare you the convention speech about how we're hurting in public education in the state. You hopefully have heard that some this session, and I can guarantee you you'll hear it more later in the session as well. Some of the testimony earlier was intriguing. It sounded as if we were making a choice between funding assessment and taxation or public safety, and if only the choice were as simple as that, but really this is really an attack on all the services we provide as government around this state. We're very sympathetic to the cause here. You know, as a unit of government that was caught up in the web of Measures 5 and 47 and 50 and the reduction in revenues that we've faced, we can talk about the $2 billion growing on $3 billion shortfall to our full funding of public education in the state. We certainly are sympathetic to that cause, but I'm not here asking you to take money from the counties and give it to me, but it does feel like that's what they're here asking you to do, is to take money from me to fund their core functions of government. This is going one step further down this road of a fee-for-service government, which we just are antithetically opposed to. You know, we believe government should be funded, broad public services by broad taxes, and that really assessment and taxation is a core function of county government and should be funded by broad taxes. We were willing participants in a work group over the interim, as was mentioned by Mr. Novak, and I'm very disheartened that there were folks here testifying in support of this bill that were also willing participants in that task force and agreed to approach that from a task force consensus approach and work for other solutions, including general fund appropriations to CAFA, the delinquent interest, as has been mentioned, and as well substantial conversation, which we support, about really looking at Measures 47 and 50 and ways that we can help some of these counties, the very counties here who have extremely low permanent tax rates that were trapped in that Measure 47 and 50 web and have an inability under the Constitution to raise those. We think that is a much more appropriate, albeit harder, a much more appropriate avenue to fully fund the services of government that all of us think are appropriate and necessary. I would urge you not to forward on House Bill 3214 and to look at any of a number of other approaches that we can take to help fully fund fund assessment and taxation around the state. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. I will be very brief and tell you that we also are in opposition to this bill, and we agree with everything that you've heard from the cities and from Mr. Williams. This, to us, appears to be the last two people on the Titanic fighting over who gets in the leaky lifeboat. This is not an answer. You are a committee that has in your power to create true solutions to the crisis and the problems in every level of government in this state. We urge you to look at those more broadly, those broader-based solutions to everyone's problem, and do not get tempted by these small cannibalizing efforts to help one at the expense of others. Thank you.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair, my apologies. I was remiss. I wanted to mention one other thing to put this in numbers fashion. 2% of school district local property tax collections, operating taxes, not bonded indebtedness, would amount to about $50 million a biennium. That's 3 days of school. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions for this panel? I take it that you're convinced that this approach would not raise you any money.
Mr. Chair, excellent question.
I mean, because that was what the others testified to.
We have always supported the notion that increased enforcement and increased staffing in collections is a way to raise additional revenue, have supported additional appropriations to the Department of Revenue, and would support additional appropriations to A&T functions around the state. We just think that this is a very inappropriate method about doing that.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Hasina Squires. You get to wrap up.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon in support of House Bill 3214. We did participate in the interim work group, and I want to make sure that the committee understands that I strongly disagree with the statement that this funding mechanism was summarily dismissed at the committee level. We supported it. School boards did not, cities did not support this method of collection. So to say that it was summarily dismissed is inaccurate in my view. Special districts, as you know, are heavily reliant on the property tax system. We support our assessors and their ability to collect our property taxes. If they can't collect our property taxes, then we will have less money and we will provide less service. So we, from our perspective, our association sees this as sort of cutting off your nose to spite your face. We need them to be fully funded. We need them to collect our property taxes, particularly in light of, as AFSCME testified, with Measure 50. New construction comes on the roll at full value. We need it. We want it. We want them out there to collect those property taxes. And, yes, they may be the least popular elected official or appointed official in the county from maybe the taxpayer perspective, but from the taxing district perspective, they are the champion for us out there collecting their our taxes and distributing them to us. I'd like to just respond to the notion that assessment and taxation is a core county function. We agree with that. It is. It's a core county function. But the notion that assessment and that county core functions are not funded by other taxing jurisdictions is not actually accurate. For instance, election costs. Counties, I would argue that counties are the core election function for the state of Oregon as it relates to local governments. Special districts pay counties for those election functions. In order for us to put something on the ballot, we pay the county for it. Cities are exempt from that, but special districts do pay. So there are core county functions that local taxing jurisdictions are paying and supporting. The Senate Bill 563, the delinquent interest bill. We also support that bill, and we hope that it will come over here and that you will support it also. It just doesn't, raise enough money for the counties. I just like to end by saying, as a former Clackamas County Budget Committee member, I can attest to the fact that the county assessor is not the most popular person in the budget. When we hear the budget, when we heard it, I served on that committee for 4 or 5 years, it was sheriffs, jails, all of the fun, pretty programs, and then it came to A&T. And what can we do for the bare minimum A&T to make sure that we don't get disqualified by the Department of Revenue? And every single year I would say, listen, A&T function has to be fully funded, and they would try to cut it because it's not exciting, and nobody wants to fund the tax collector because nobody believes if you let them collect it, it will come. If you give them the tools, they will, we believe, collect more money for taxing districts, including the cities and the counties and schools and special districts. If you cut them to the bone, you're just going to receive less money and less level of service.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. I very much appreciate the testimony that we've received this morning on this bill. And with that, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3214, and we will open our work session on House Bill 2472. Chris, we've gotten a bunch of new amendments, haven't we?
Yes.
And would you help us by going through that, and let's, colleagues, we have also scheduled this bill for work tomorrow, and so I don't expect that we're going to do anything other than discuss it today, but let's go ahead and do that.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. In your packet, you have amendments roughly going from -9 through -17, with a couple of omissions there. In front of that, at the front of the packet, you have a cheat sheet entitled House Bill 2472 Amendments. And the amendments that will be the focus of today will be from the -9s moving forward. The -9s represent a combination. It's kind of a rebasing that was discussed in the last committee hearing on this. And it combines earlier versions of amendments. It combines the -4, -6, and -7. And so what I've done to try and provide some context for your discussion today was provide a section-by-section description of the -9, which you should also see in your packet right underneath the cheat sheet. And what the -9 does, it's a gut and stuff for 2472 with all of the policies that were in the drafted 3411, in addition to six other policies that had been discussed. And those other policies are adding electrical vehicle manufacturers to the definition of the renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities, reducing the $20 million cap to $10 million, eliminating the automatic 10% increase in the certified costs, and then making the bill apply to pre-certifications issued on or after the effective date of the bill. And then a couple of other changes relating to the pre-certification process. The original language had the applicants being required to obtain all the state and local licenses and permits for pre-certification. The -9 has them applying for all those permits and licenses for the pre-certification, and then prohibiting the Department of Energy from issuing a final certification until the applicant has obtained all of those licenses and permits. The -9s also remove, there's something that's missing that got pulled out, and that was in the additional pre-cert criteria. There was a statement about an environmental impact, and that has been removed. And so that's out of the -9, so it's not in there. And so those were the amendments that had been discussed last time, and those are all wrapped up into the -9, so that's kind of the framework for the discussion. Now, Mr. Chair, we can just march through the rest of the amendments if you'd like, or how would you like to proceed?
Well, perhaps if you could hit briefly how the additional amendments that we've received today are different, I think that might be helpful. One of our problems is going to be that we've got so many amendments to consider now that it will be easy to get lost in the weeds if we're not careful.
Okay.
So why don't you hit briefly what those are? I can tell you that I'm going to be scribbling on the top of these amendments notes so that I have an idea of what we're talking about.
Here. So I'm going through those amendments and kind of side by side with the cheat sheet here. The dash 10 we just received this morning, so in that handout I have it listed as unknown. But what that does, the way Ledge Council drafted these is that they are all gut and stuffs for 2472. So, for example, if you're looking at the dash 10, most of that bold language is from the original 3411. The policy piece that's different in the dash 10 is on page 2, lines 28 through 30. And so this is the only place that policy that exists. And what that does is modify the projects eligible for the 20 million cap for certified costs. And it allows that the $20 million cap to be only for those facilities with installed capacity of 25 megawatts or less. So that's the twist in the dash 10. And rather than just changing it from 20 million to 10 million for all, it does it for a subset of them. It still allows the 20 million for certain projects.
Yes, right.
And Mr. Chair, these are considered small projects, in other words?
I don't know. We may ask Mr. Graney that question. But what I'd like to do is just finish.
You want to go through them all, and then
finish these quickly, and then we'll come back and answer these questions that are coming. I think the next one is also on the same topic, but with a different solution.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. The change there again is on page 2, line 28. It's a broader. It's broader in some sense in that it just reduces the $20 million to $15 million. So it's, again, a variation on that theme of modifying that $20 million cap. The Dash 12 and Dash 13 deal with the energy trust, so those are obsolete. You can move those off the table a couple meetings ago.
Oh, that's good. If you get two, we can get rid of.
All right. Mm-hmm. The Dash 14 is also a slight variation on a prior theme. You can see the language there. On page 2, lines 20 and 21, this removes the automatic 10% overrun cost. But the new piece to this policy is on page 3, lines 6 and 7. It puts a sunset on that elimination. So that automatic increase, that automatic 10% increase only exists for a couple of years. And that sunset date for the decrease is January 1, 2011. So this is similar to the Dash 6.
Okay.
The Dash 15, the twist here is, again, focusing on the projects that are eligible for the $20 million cap. It reduces it to $10 million, but, again, puts a two-year sunset on that. And you can see the sunset on page 2, lines 25 and 26. And then... Okay, the Dash 16 and the Dash 17 are more extensive in nature. And the Dash 16, I'm kind of going off the cheat sheet now rather than trying to point out line numbers, which we can do, but it provides priority to certain projects. Those that have the greatest amount of energy savings, have the greatest amount of net carbon emissions reductions, and have the lowest cost per job ratios. And it sets a maximum cost per job ratio of $30,000. And defines the cost per job ratio and defines permanent jobs in the bill.
Can I ask how it sets priority? What priority means exactly?
I think that's a great question we ought to ask the proponents when we get to it.
And the Dash 17 is actually similar to the Dash 8, so if I could actually have you flip back to the Dash 8. It's, again, gives the theme there is giving priority to certain projects, and the Dash 8 or the Dash 17 would require the applicant to pledge to create or retain permanent jobs in Oregon if 80% of the jobs pay the medium manufacturing wage. The Dash 8 includes a health insurance piece. The Dash 17 does not. That's the only difference, I believe, between the Dash 8 and the Dash 17. The bill also then goes into defining... cost per job and providing priority to those with the lowest cost per job. And then there's some language in there about jobs that meet or exceed the prevailing wage for large projects, if the project costs are over $750,000. So that, at a rather high level, those are the policies contained in the amendments that you have before you.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris, are there any amendments here that we can't mix and match? For example, the Dash 9s seem to be a fairly comprehensive amendment. Could that say, even though that already changes the $20 million to the $10 million, could it say be combined with the $20 to $10 million sunset change in the Dash 15, even though that part is redundant, but then the sunset would apply to things in Dash 9?
Representative Bailey, in talking to Ledge Council, because you're dealing with one bill and the amendment process, if the committee adopts two bills that deal with different language, they can fuse them together to make the policy work. There can be a complicating factor if two separate amendments have absolutely conflicting language.
Sure.
And in that case, what they would want to do is draft a combined amendment that clarifies.
Right. What I'd like to do, and I don't know whether this is possible or not, but what I'd like to do is get the committee, is to understand the consensus of the committee, if there is one, well enough so that we can draft a combined amendment that includes all the pieces that are likely to get a majority vote, and then proceed from there. There are some issues that significantly complicate the thing, because we're moving the... We're moving the cap several different ways on renewable energy devices. We're talking about jobs in a couple of amendments that don't occur anywhere else. I think that we have settled. I'd like head nods if it's true. I think we have settled on a couple of minor amendments having to do with applications for permits and licenses. So we changed that word complied to. New language in, I think it's the Dash 9s, and I think we've also agreed that we're going to leave out the piece on environmental impact, which I think that change also gets made in the Dash 9s. I think we've pretty much agreed on those two things. I don't know that we've agreed on the others, and I'd like to have Mr. Graney come forward and perhaps talk about those limits. And Representative Berger, you have something.
The other thing that I had understood that we'd agreed was the energy trust thing was not...
Oh, was not in there. That's
was
right.
Was not in there. And
correct.
I just wanted to put that
I think we've... Yeah, so we've simplified the bill that much. Yeah. So there's some drafts here that absolutely will not work because they continue to contain the old language. Mm-hmm. The Dash 16s, for example... may work if we decide to get into the jobs issue, but they absolutely will not work on the pieces that we've just talked about because those are still in there the wrong way. Mr. Graney, what I'd like you to talk about, and maybe other members have other ideas, but I'd like you to talk about the two issues of a very short sunset on the 10% overrun and the change in the cap from $20 million to $10 million. That's one issue, the sunset. And right. The other issue is the cap itself. Mm-hmm. There are two different proposals, right. Three different proposals. One is to move it to 10 from 20. Right. The second one is to move it to 15 from 20. Right. And the third one is to keep it at 20 for projects that are below 25 megawatts.
Right.
Could you comment on those? I think probably six ideas.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'll try. Good morning. Mike Graney from Department of Energy. Mr. Chairman, I think the decisions you make on any of those issues will be guided by how much you think you need to reduce the revenue impact.
And there's one other issue, and that is the effectiveness of the program.
Yes, yes, Mr.
I mean, that is a major concern
yes.
to us.
Yes.
That we not mm-hmm. take action which saves a lot of money but has a major negative impact on the program.
Right, right, Mr. Chairman. I believe that's right. And I think, you know, it's hard to draw the line on where you're going to have... I think these changes will have an impact on the program because there will be less projects because all these amendments, at least say that are in the dash nines, the provisions that are in there now, do reduce the revenue impact, so that means we've had an impact on projects. Where you hit the line on, do we go beyond serious damage to the efforts to develop renewable energy and save energy, I think is a judgment you'll have to make given the balancing on your needs for revenue. But addressing, I guess, specific points, from department's perspective, we would have no objection to a sunset on any of these provisions that reduce the program. So if you wanted to have a short period or a shorter period than just the duration of the program, we would have no objection to that. On
now, before we go on,
okay.
Would that likely influence applications? Let me tell you what I'm thinking. Suppose I am a developer and I want to use the caps that are in the current law, and I know that this bill that we've put is going to sunset soon. In what year did we decide? Did we put here?
2011.
At the end of 2010.
Right, Mr. Chairman.
Couldn't I just wait a year and a half and then apply?
Mr. Chairman, it could. There could be some projects that would be affected by that cap that might wait, especially ones where I think it's where the proportion of the tax credit to the cost of the project is much higher, which is the smaller community-based projects. That could be a factor. I can't tell you how many. I can't tell you how much of a weight of the factor. I think there's other people, developers, and industry representatives who could give you a better sense of that. But that is a possibility.
Representative Riley and then Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a concern about these sunsets because I can see if I'm going to develop a project and I want to start now, I'm going to have this cap, but if I wait 2 years, I may not have that cap. I'm going to wait. And we don't really want, I don't believe, to cause that wait.
Thank you. Representative Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Riley. Both your questions kind of lead to mine, which is to ask, I think you both expressed legitimate concerns. I wonder if there's also a flip concern or on the other side, to suggest that if we're able to send the message to the larger world and investment community that we're responding to our budget challenges, but that it doesn't represent a change or new disinterest in the program. Do you have any sense of how that might affect interest and going forward?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Reed, again, I think that is an important message. I don't know the reaction. I mean, I do think with most of the options you discussed here, I think the program will still be effective. There have been concerns I know that you've heard about on specific measures, especially the reduction from $20 million to $10 million. That's probably the one that certainly I've heard the most about.
From whom?
From developers and wind developers and also from local governments where these are local counties where these projects have been developed.
Thank you. And now on the other topic, 20 to 15, 20 to 10, or 20 limited to 25 megawatts?
Right. Mr. Chairman, both of those will reduce the revenue impact. I can't tell you, or reduce the revenue impact savings. I can't tell you how much. Going from $20 million to $15 million, we estimated going from $20 to $10 million would save about $16 million or so next biennium. Presumably this might be half of that. On the project for 25 megawatts or less, to give you a sense, and we haven't done any estimate on that, so I can't tell you what that would be, other than it would be a smaller proportion of this. But size-wise, the wind turbines that you see on the highways are anywhere from 0.75 megawatt to, now the most recent ones are up to 3 megawatts, the large utility-scale wind farms. costs are running generally at least $2 million a megawatt. So to get to 20 megawatts, get to $20 million of eligible cost only takes about 10 megawatts. And we do have projects that are anywhere from 3 to 10 megawatts. I've got a list of 9 projects with me, and those get up to 20 megawatts individually pretty quickly, $20 million pretty quickly. So they would be impacted by a reduction of 20 to 10 million or 20 to 15 million dollars. There tends to be, in the trade, we tend to talk about small scale being 20 megawatts or less. And 20 megawatts is clearly over the $10 million and $20 million cost range. And then after that, there's a significant jump to utility scale, which tends to be over 100 megawatts. The big wind farms can be anywhere from 100 to 300 megawatts of size.
Okay. Representative Pence.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you give us a percentage of projects that is on the small scale, which you said under, let's use 25.
Right.
What are we looking at on the board number of small-scale projects?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bence, I'd have to get you more detailed numbers. We know that of the 2,000-plus projects that we certified last year, 23 of them were greater than $5 million, and 12 of them were greater than $10 million. And those projects were the 75% of the revenue impact. I'd have to give you a more detailed breakdown of the type of distinction you're making in terms of numbers of projects. But we do have both large and small ones. In terms of, we do have projects that, like I say, I just had a list here, 9 of them that run from 3 megawatts to 10 megawatts. Which in the aggregate are over $135 million of potential cost. And we also have pending some applications for some large utility scale projects.
Yes, please. Yeah.
How many of these projects, these small-scale projects, are going to be interrupted by this legislation, if passed? And by interrupted, I mean affected, in your opinion, to the point that they would not proceed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bence, I think with the Dash 9 amendments, or with the Dash 9 amendments, with some of the additional modifications you're discussing, I think most of those would still go forward. I think most of both the large and the small ones would still go forward.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a space of $2.5 million between the 20 and the proposed 15. When we talk about small projects, how many of those, quote, small projects would be impacted negatively if we adopted the 15 cap as opposed to the small 25 meg cap? Because the 25 meg cap, of course, leaves us at 20.
Well, the 25 megawatt cap would mean that I think none of the smaller projects would be impacted compared to, dropping the $20 million to $10 million limit on everybody.
Yeah, please.
Right. But one of the other amendments suggests that instead of dropping from 20 to 10, we drop to 15. So my question is, how many projects are going to be caught between the 20 and 50?
There will be some. There will be some. The list I was just looking at, two-thirds of those would be. So we do have projects that, if you're in the 5 to 10 megawatt range, then you're between $10 and $20 million of cost.
Okay, so the savings would be very, very small with the 25 megawatt limit, as compared to dropping the $20 million cap to any amount below that.
Mr. Chairman, if I follow you,
I mean, it would affect only the very large.
It would affect the large ones.
Right.
So there would still be some revenue savings.
Right, but I think you pointed out that there were something like 10 or 15 very large projects that this would affect, whereas the vast majority of projects in terms of numbers are smaller.
Well, and the vast majority of projects are the energy efficiency that wouldn't be really affected,
at all.
Yeah.
Thank you. Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've received some correspondence from various small project promoters, and they indicate that, in their opinion, these smaller projects are more positive from a local community basis, more jobs, work with the local community than, let's say, these bigger projects. In your opinion, is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, I think there's benefits from both large and small, and I guess in terms of how they work with the local communities, I mean, that's going to depend on the developer. But there are definitely beneficial impacts in terms of both employment and taxes and sort of multiplier effect benefits from both large and small projects.
Yep, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They reference a March 2006 OSU study of Umatilla County that found local investor projects, such as our 10-megawatt project, have the potential of returning 3.5 times more than non-locally owned projects. Are you familiar with that study, and does that sound right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bentz, personally, I haven't read that study. I don't know if my staff have. We'd be glad to get back to you on that.
Thank you.
I think it'd be wonderful if there is such a study, if we had it. It'd be great if you could find it and get it to us.
We'd be glad to do that.
It's obvious to me that we're not going to finish this today or tomorrow, so we'll have time to look at it if you get it to us soon.
Okay.
I would like to look at the other topic in the last couple of minutes. We've had two amendments that relate to jobs issues, and I'm very interested in understanding how the jobs amendments, I think it's 16 and 17, and I guess not earlier than that, maybe 8 and perhaps another one,
right.
would affect. Now, one of these, number 16, limits job cost to $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with this proposal? And if so, is this a restriction that works, or what could you tell us?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have seen this language. Just like you say, this was an earlier version of it. It was in the Dash 8s. Mm-hmm. I have some concerns because these two amendments apply to off projects.
Yes.
Just simply going through the amount of work that's required and the reviewing the criteria for the thousands of project applications we get. We've been struggling with the workload and in terms of timeliness as it is. I think this would just be overwhelming. And then given the fact the language now says priority to, as opposed to, I think some of the earlier language said deny a credit entirely, I'm not sure what priority means other than moving them up in the chain of responding, and we try to turn around all the applications as quick as we can as it is. So I have some concerns about these as they're drafted.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, I represent Carl.
Yeah, and maybe to speak to that, I had a lot of questions about priority as well, and it seems like that, to me, that language is a holdover from when the proposal was a firm cap.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're giving priority to an applicant when there is a limited potential benefit out there, then priority makes sense.
Right.
But given that we're working this into a new bill, mm-hmm. priority seems to me not to be an adequate term or an adequate vehicle through which to effectuate these goals. And I'm wondering, putting priority aside, is there a way to get at some of this job creation?
Uh-huh.
And full well knowing that we're also trying to save generate some real revenue here to save really necessary programs.
And let me add to that question, because we don't have much time, and I wouldn't normally do this, Representative Gall.
No, please.
Let me add this issue. It seems to me that there are many, many projects that create a very short-term construction job or so, but no jobs after that at all. A photovoltaic installation on a roof, caulking windows, those kinds of things.
Right.
The only ones that I think could possibly qualify for this $30,000 rule in the normal course of things would either be very highly effective conservation jobs, mm-hmm. or manufacturing jobs, mm-hmm. where what we're talking about is actually the manufacturing piece of this.
Right.
Would you comment on that issue as well as what Representative Call has raised?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Call, I think you're both correct. I do think that these criteria really don't make sense for the thousands of energy efficiency projects that we get that are primarily intended to save energy, and that we do have cost-effective criteria on so that the measures have to meet that. That helps the businesses reduce their energy costs and continue operating. It may save some jobs, but it's hard for us to quantify that, certainly on an individual project. I think that, as you've mentioned, we have, for the large projects with the Dash 9 amendments, you now have a requirement that we look at the economic benefits. And then, of course, the manufacturing facilities have specific job creation requirements and other economic benchmarks that we have to make a finding on and condition the site certificate, or excuse me, the tax credit certificate on, and the company has to meet fulfill those requirements.
So at least a portion of what this amendment is after has already been done, yeah. In 08.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
The manufacturing side.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Thank you. We have about 2 minutes. Anything else that we can hit right now? Colleagues, it's my intention to circulate a questionnaire. I need to get some sense as to where the committee is on these various ideas so that we have some hope of actually reducing the complexity of this thing and getting it into a form that we can adopt. I'm personally convinced that some action in order to streamline this process and reduce our costs without seriously affecting the really useful projects is something we need to do, but we could easily get buried in the details. We're scheduled for work session on this tomorrow. Is that right, Paul? We're scheduled for work session tomorrow on this, and so we'll come back and look at it again. I'm going to try to get that questionnaire out today. If I'm successful in that, I would really appreciate your getting back to me immediately. I would be astounded if we can actually work it tomorrow, given where we are. But I'd like to have further discussion about it at that time. Okay. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Committee, we're going to close the work session now, and we have to all get onto the floor. We will adjourn for today.
You don't need to.
I don't need to ask
me.
You. Okay. You're,